17. Come now, who you who say, today or tomorrow, we will go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit. Yet you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow, for just vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and also do this or that. But as it is, you boast in your arrogance, and such boasting is evil. Therefore, to one who knows the right thing and does to do and does not do it, to him it is sin.
Several years now, when you get close to the NCAA basketball tournament, they've tried to decide who the number one seeds are and that sort of thing. And more recently, now this year with the football playoff coming around, and in recent years, the BCS championship, when they try to decide who belongs in these tournaments and who should be seeded the highest, a phrase that I have heard repeatedly for about the last 5 or 6 years is the phrase, body of work. And what they mean is you kind of look at the big picture of this team and how they performed across the season and that sort of thing. When you think about the Christian, what is your body of work? Your body of work is not a game that you played. It may not be how much money you made. It may not have anything to do with the normal metrics that our culture uses to measure success. Your body of work is your life. Your body of work is what you did on a day-to-day basis. Your body of work is how you lived out your faith from the time you got up in the morning to the time you went to bed at night, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. That's your body of work. I was reminded about this last week with the death of Florence McMullen. Many of you knew her. She moved away from here in, I think, about 2005 or so. So some of the newer members may not know her, but those of us who were here long enough to know her knew her body of work. And it was an impressive body of work. I've met few people who were more dedicated as servants of the Lord than Florence. And everywhere she went, she left a very positive impact. I've had the chance to visit the congregation down in Richmond a couple of times. I had contact with the preacher there several times and just a few times visiting the people down there, and they all talked about the wonderful influence she had in that congregation. When I preached her funeral this last week on, I believe it was Wednesday, I just talked about some of the things that I remembered about her work as a Christian, just her influence in this congregation, just her presence here. And that was her body of work. And when I think about that, I think about the text that we just read from James chapter 4. Now, verse 14 that was just read, the text that was read was the New American Standard. This version says, yet you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You are just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. The King James and also the NIV take the first part of verse 14 and turn it into a question. It asks, what is your life? That's a good question. What is your life? What is your life before God? What is your life before men? What is your body of work? As people look at your life, can they see what you were dedicated to? Can they see what your priorities were? Can they see how you served others and how you served the living God? That's the answer to the question, what is your life? And I want us to think about that today as we reflect on this passage from the end of James chapter 4. James was writing to a group of Jewish Christians, probably in Palestine. In my opinion, James may have been the very first epistle written in the New Testament. In my guess, probably in the mid to late 40s. Christianity was still a relatively new thing, but the Jews were the first body of people to embrace it. That's who the apostles taught to in the early stages of the church's history. They taught to Jews in the synagogues, and many, many of them obeyed. James, the Lord's brother, apparently lived out his life in the city of Jerusalem and worked among these people, knew them well, and he makes a lot of appeals to them throughout this letter. But when you get to the end of your life, most people live, I think the average age now is like 75 point something or 78 point something, depending on who you read. If you live 70 years on this earth, you'll have an impact on someone. In Florence's case, she lived to be 90. She would have been 91 this coming March. And that leaves an impact. That leaves an indelible print on the world around you. How did you live those years? How did any of us live the years that we have? As the one song says, shall you reap glory or shall you reap tears as the result of how you lived your life? What is your life? There's basically two answers. It's a life either dedicated to God or dedicated to something less than God. That something less, more often than not, is self. Now, we can couch it in any number of phrases. We can couch it in any number of images. But ultimately, you're either living for God or you're living for self. And there is no middle ground. You can't have a little bit of both. You can't sneak through life and say, well, I'm gonna get around the Lord here a little bit. No, you're fooling yourself. You can't sneak through life and say, well, I'm serving the Lord, kind of, sort of. No, you either are or you're not. And James helps us to understand this by looking at the picture of life as a series of opportunities. What are you doing with the opportunities you have right in front of you? Not what you plan to do down the road. Not what you're going to do one of these days when all the circumstances are right. What are you doing right now? What is your life right now? So let's look then at this text. We'll start with James' description of human life in verse 13 and 14. He says, come now, you who say today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit, yet you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You are just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. First of all, it's a picture of busyness. And I spelled it that way on purpose. I suppose that is a synonym for the B-U-S-I-N-E-S-S. But I think our lives are full of this. Busyness. I honestly wonder sometimes how we manage to do what we do. I'm young enough to vaguely remember what my childhood years were like. And I don't ever remember being as busy as our kids are. Our kids are constantly having faced this barrage of requests that everybody wants a piece of your time. Just as an adult, it just seems like we are constantly busy. And James talks about that a little bit. He talks about the coming and going of life. We go to this place, we go to that place. All of the business transactions, the buying and the selling. He talks here about being here or there or this place or that place. He talks about gains and losses. That's the stuff of everyday life. And it is a picture of busyness. But the danger in all of this busyness that we face is assuming that we're the ones in control. Well, I understand. Your name is on everything that you agreed to do. You agree to belong to this organization. You agree to work this many hours. You agree to this many hours on your schedule in school. Or you agree to this organization or that sport. Or this shopping trip, or that adventure, or whatever it is, your name's on every one of those things. You agreed to them at some point. So yes, you are somewhat in control of your circumstances. But there's a very real sense in which we have almost no control of what goes on in our lives as far as just the busyness that surrounds us. We are faced every day with forces upon us that sometimes we just can't control. But those things that we can control, it's important to take control of them and do what we can to enhance our relationship to God rather than destroy it. It's also a picture of uncertainty. There are a lot of things I don't control. There's a lot of things you don't control in your life. You remember Scarlett O'Hara? Gone with the Wind. What was her mantra? Well, there's always tomorrow. No, there isn't. You don't know that. I don't know that. None of us know that. Do you remember the song? I'm dating myself here. Lean on me. there's always tomorrow.
No, we don't.
We're arrogant if we assume that. We're arrogant if we think that's how this life operates. In fact, he warns them in verse 14, you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You're not even sure if there will be a tomorrow. How often have you made big plans for the next day and you wake up and you're sick as a dog and had to completely change your schedule? That's frustrating, isn't it? It's just a reminder that I don't always have the control that I think I do. Or how often do you plan something at work or school, and you get there and everything is ready, but the other person or the other people involved didn't bring what they were supposed to? Or they botched something, or they forgot something, or they ignored something. They didn't get that email that you sent to them. You thought you had control, but you didn't. Or we get together at family times and we think this is going to happen, and it doesn't. Our first Christmas together, when Wheatley and I were married, our first Christmas together, we were sitting at her parents' house. We were there. Her brother and his wife were there, and her parents were there. We were enjoying ourselves. We had been to my parents already, had a nice little celebration. We were thinking, I said, this is really nice. We're going to have a relaxing few days. And I believe it was on Christmas Day we got a phone call that my mother-in-law's father was seriously ill and in the hospital. I believe he'd had a heart attack. And that was all the way down in Arkansas. So we all packed up. And the next day, we drove down there. Lincoln and I had something we had to do, so we stopped at the hospital, said hello to her grandfather, went someplace else. Then we came back, and while we were gone, he died. We had a funeral. That was a memorable experience. That's not exactly how we pictured our first Christmas together. You don't know what your life will be like tomorrow. There is always that giant question mark. There is always that giant uncertainty that looms over each day of our lives. Over in Luke's Gospel, in Luke chapter 12, Jesus illustrated this by talking about a man who was very wealthy. We're told in Luke 12 and verse 16, the land, the rich man, was very productive. He began reasoning to himself, saying, what shall I do since I have no place to store my crops? And he said, this is what I'll do. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods, and I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years to come. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. And God said, you fool. This very night your soul is required of you. Now, what will you do? Who will own all of those things that you have prepared? He assumed he was preparing for retirement. Do any of you get literature in the mail about retirement planning? Well, you should. You should be a good steward of your possessions, but remember this, you may never reach retirement. Or retirement may not be what you thought it was. It might be what you thought were going to be your golden years turn into the rust years. And we have to face those disappointments. Life is full of uncertainty. It's also a picture of brevity. He says, your life, if you go back to our text in James, you are just a vapor, or you are like a vapor that appears for a while and then vanishes away. It's a wisp of smoke or a wisp of steam. You ever blow out a candle? What happens to that smoke? It's there for just a moment or two or three, and then it disappears. Or you're cooking something on the stove. About the time the steam gets about this far above the pot, it just disappears from your sight. And your life is like that. It's hard for me. I'm 54 years old, and it's hard for me to think of my life as a vapor that just disappears. But I can attest to this, and I know people my age and older can attest to this, that the longer you live, the quicker it goes. I'm still reeling from the fact that I have two married children. That just doesn't seem possible. I remember that stupid grin on Nate's face when he was a little boy. And now his wife has to put up with it. It's just amazing how quickly time has passed. And it keeps going ever more quickly. That is James' picture of the life that we live here on this earth. that's what human life is like. But then he moves on in verse 15 to the godly life. The real issue in all of this is who is in charge. And so he says in verse 15, instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and also do this or that. Now, James is not condemning planning. He's not condemning buying an organizer and filling it out and marking the dates and circling this and that. He's not opposed to any of that, and neither should you be opposed to it. Planning ahead is a prudent thing. We have to make assumptions about what life will be like this coming week. I'm sure most everybody here has probably in some way made some kind of plans about what you're going to do New Year's Day or New Year's Eve. You have to make those kinds of plans. The problem is the assumptions that we make about it. You know, I hope to do this. I want to do that. And James says what we ought to say is, if the Lord wills. There are a lot of common attitudes that people have about their lives. And very often these attitudes are not particularly godly. There's fatalism. Fatalism is the idea, well, why bother? Why make any plans? Because I may not be here anyway. Well, that's true. But you don't just give up because of that. You don't just stop living. You still have to make decisions. You still have to live your life. And you still live it under the scrutiny of God. Why bother? Because of God. What's the use? God. God is there. And he's very interested in your life. So having this fatalistic attitude that, well, I just throw my hands up in despair, that won't do. You've been blessed by God with the life that you have. Whatever the quality may be in your opinion, it still comes to you from God. And it's still an important thing that you have to do. There are people who live their life full of indifference. Whatever. It is what it is. Whatever happens, happens. Que sera, sera. What will be, will be. I don't think that's any better. You ought to care about something. You ought to, in caring about God, making that the dynamic of your life, gives you an interest in a lot of things. And it shapes your whole perspective on everything you do. It shapes your perspective on your relationships. It shapes your perspective on your job, on your education, on your money and possessions. It affects everything you think. It affects everything you do. It affects everything you own. You can't be indifferent about life because, again, it comes to us from God. There is presumptuousness, another common attitude. And I mention it frequently, but guys like Richard Dawkins drive me nuts. He's a loudmouth atheist, and he's got a very good publisher and a very good agent. He has a mouthpiece, and it is his books, and he openly makes fun of people who are religious. He openly despises the concept of God. And as much influence as he may or may not have, and as irritating as I find him, you know what the real threat is? People like me and you who say we believe in God, but don't live that way. It's the practical side of atheism. It's living as if there is no God, whether you say you believe in him or not. That's the real danger, is that we go through life and people look at us and can't see a bit of difference in the quality of our lives and the quality of the atheist life who lives next door. If they cannot see a difference, there's a problem. And if they can't see a difference, it may be because we're not pursuing godliness in the way that we ought to. To live presumptuously is as big a sin as anything. And he warns against that. Again, he says in verse 15, instead you ought to say, rather than assuming this about your day-to-day life, he says you need to have this attitude that if the Lord wills, we will do this or that. And there's a religious version of fatalism. And that's where we just kind of say, well, you know, God's in control, and he is. But we don't pray. We don't really believe that praying makes a difference. We really don't believe that God intervenes graciously in our lives. If that's the case, that is just as bad. What he wants us to do is put our trust in him and show that in the way we live our life, in our priorities. Have I included God in all of my plans? In our purpose for living? Do I understand the purpose of my existence here on this earth? Do I understand my purpose as a husband or a father? Do I understand my purpose in relationship to God as a member of this congregation? Do I understand my purpose in life when I go to the workplace and how that reflects back on God? The godly life always, it doesn't just include God. God is the very center of it. And everything we do is measured by that, and everything we do is indexed by that. That's what it means to live a godly life. And it ultimately means that we have faith in God. That if my plans don't work out the way I think they ought to go, I know that God's plans are always good. And I know that the Lord will take care of things. Whether they turn out the way I expected, whether they turn out the way I wanted, is irrelevant. It ultimately comes back to my trust that God will do good by whatever I do in my own life. And then finally, that's supposed to say, James, that's what it just said. There you go. Verse 16. James' last description is his description of the wasted life. He says in verse 16 and 17, "But as it is, you boast in your arrogance, and all such boasting is evil. Therefore, to one who knows the right thing to do and does it not, to him it is sin." He identifies two basic sins that we commit when we don't include God, when we don't put God at the center of our life. Number one, we become arrogant. Arrogance is just placing an undue emphasis on yourself, having an exceptionally high view of your opinion and your talents and all of that. Look, you may be a 10-talent person, you may be a 5-talent person, you may be a 1-talent person. It really doesn't matter. All that came from God, and it's on loan to you, and he expects you to use it to his glory. Our problem is we think that we are the captains of our own fate. And he says, all such boasting is arrogant, and it is evil. To just assume that I'm going to do this or that. I have a good friend of mine, when I first started preaching, he was one of my mentors when I first started. And he talked about a friend of his. I had no idea who he was other than just the reference to him. They said, a friend of his was a guy by the name of Danny. He went to high school with him. They were very good friends. And he said, all Danny talked about when he was in high school, he wanted to grow up, get a job, get rich, and retire, and I think he said by the age of 35. And this guy had a plan. He knew what he wanted to do, and he had milestones and markers and goals, and he set all these goals, and he was well on his way to accomplishing this, and he was headed toward being a millionaire by the age of 35 and being able to retire, except for one minor little detail. He died. He forgot to include God. I had a good friend of mine, David. We practically grew up together. We were in junior high and high school together. His family, for many years, worshipped at the congregation on the other side of town. When they got into high school, I think they placed membership with us. And I knew him in high school and college. David was one of the nicest guys you would ever meet. Unfortunately, he was a drug addict. And he struggled with that his whole adult life. At one point, he was married, and he seemed to be doing a little bit better. And then I got a call from my dad one time. He said, did you hear what happened to David? And I said, no. David, with his dad, they ran a cleaning business. His dad, I think his older brother, ran a cleaning business in town. And one day, he was just out riding his truck. His truck stalled on the railroad track and got hit, and he died. David kept talking about coming back to the Lord. And he never did. He had plenty of opportunities that he wasted. He was going to come back to the Lord. He was going to get things right. But given us plenty of opportunities. What are we doing with them? And he says it is also sinful. It's a sin because it wastes opportunities. He says, therefore, to the one who knows the right thing to do and does it not, to him it is sin. We call those sins of omission or sins of neglect. We have the opportunity to do this, but instead we opt not to. It is a failure to do the right thing. Time, once it is killed, cannot be resurrected. You can't get it back. The Greeks had a lot of images about time. They had a lot of different words for time. One of their images was a man who, as he walked towards you, was hairy. He had a full head of hair, a full beard, a full mustache, and then as he walked by on the backside, he was completely bald. In other words, as it came to you, you could grab it. Once it was passed, there was nothing to seize on to. And that's the way time is. Once it gets passed, you can't have it again. How often have you put things off till tomorrow what should have been done today? Now, I'm not saying that every day that we have to do things just as quickly as we can. I'm not saying that it's ever a sin to put something off until tomorrow. But our problem is we do far too much of that. And sometimes we don't do today what we should because we're either lazy or indifferent. We don't care. It's not that important to us. How many times have you made excuses for yourself that if I only had, and fill in the blank, if I only had more time, if I only had more money, if I only had a wife or children, or if I only had a better job, or if I only had a better house, or if you can just fill in the blanks all you want to and excuse your life into oblivion. And at the end of it all, it winds up being a waste. What is your excuse for not obeying the gospel of Jesus Christ? What is your excuse for not becoming a Christian? Whatever excuse you're using now, you probably used before. Well, it's just not convenient. Well, I just need to think about it. I know a girl up in Iowa. I've known her for over 20 years. And every time I have asked about her, well, she's thinking about it. She's thinking about becoming a Christian. I don't know that she ever will. Because the same excuses that she has used, she continues to use. What reason will you give for not obeying Jesus Christ as Lord? When we talk about this with Bible study, we talk about this with prayer. We talk about it with hospitality. We talk about it with personal work. Well, I would, but. Well, what's the but? Maybe we need to reframe it and say, I would do what God commands me to do, but. Now, how do you improve on that? Oh, yeah, serving the Lord is important, but there is no but that answers to that. There's nothing you can say that makes that sentence sound any better. It's sin, it's arrogance, it's defiance toward God. What excuses do we use on a day-to-day basis for not doing the will of God? And some people try to couch it in terms of fear. Well, I'm just not sure I can do it. Paul said, I can do all things through him who strengthens me. We sometimes, when I think about Paul for just a moment, we think, oh, what a great Christian. You know why he was a great Christian? Because he learned how to serve a great master. And Paul would have been the first to tell you, and he did tell you this in 1 Corinthians 15, by the grace of God, I am what I am. It had nothing to do with Paul's talent. It had nothing to do with Paul's gritty determination. It had to do with his absolute reliance in everything he did upon an amazing Savior. So, what is your life? What is your life? I mentioned Florence's funeral. It was very well attended. I don't know, 60, 70 people were there. A lot of them from church, a lot of people that knew her and her family through the years were there. I've been preaching funerals for probably 30-something, for not quite 30 years. I still remember the first one I ever did. And through through the years, I've done some awfully sad funerals. The saddest ones were for people who had the opportunity to do something with their lives, and they never got around to doing it. I preached funerals where there was the preacher, the undertaker, and a few other folks, because no one else knew them, no one else cared about them. They lived their lives in absolute obscurity and did not do a blessed thing with their lives. I've seen people who wasted their lives on alcohol and drugs and worldliness and every considerable thing. The house was packed. But what can you say to comfort someone that you know is going to hell? We delude ourselves in that way. What is your life? Is it a life that is being led by God or led by self? Is it dedicated to God or dedicated to self? It's one of those two things. And if God is not the right answer, you've got a problem that needs to be fixed. We want to help you with that while we stand and sing.